This half hour being brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. Ford, Kia, Hyundai, the best in new inventory. Great pre-owned inventory with the all-important Sunbury Motors guarantee because they go over every vehicle individually. Great service department, whether it's quick lane or inspections, routine, difficult, they handle it all at Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. And we bring in one of the absolute best in the business, Tim Kirchen. Tim, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
So I want to start with the Tampa Bay situation. Now, we know they're going to go play over at Steinbrenner Field, which is next to the Bucs Stadium. But long term, what snag have they run into with the possibility of a new park that was supposed to be there in 28? What's the new snag now?
Well, it's the same as the other snags. The people in St. Petersburg want to keep them in St. Petersburg. But there are so many snags involved here that this is really, really tricky. You know, Bud Selig told me 15 years ago, as the commissioner of baseball, we have to fix what's going on in Oakland and Tampa Bay. 15 years ago,
yeah.
And we still haven't fixed it. So there are all sorts of issues out there, all of them financial, and that's why it's just not as simple as it was, all right, we're going to have a new stadium ready in 2028. Well, it doesn't appear that's going to happen now. So there are many snags, but they're similar snags. It's money, it's bond issues, it's all that. It's a very complicated situation.
Now, are the A's pretty much settled on Las Vegas now, or is there anything, any other hurdles to clear there between now and when they're supposed to go?
Well, I think they'll end up in Las Vegas, yes. But I say think because I'm not 1,000% sure about this. It sure looks like it's going to happen, and they're going to play in Sacramento until then. But, you know, until you see a shovel in the ground, you're never quite sure about these things. I mean, moving a franchise is very, very difficult and complicated to do. But I think it's going to happen. I think the A's are going to end up in Las Vegas, but not still 1,000% sure.
Because of these two situations, what kind of a clamp does that put on the possibility of expansion? And I ask for two reasons, because they've talked about the A's and Rays. They want that settled first before they expand. Because then the possibility is, say, one of the moves, they could take one of the cities that was thought to be an expandable city.
Yeah, exactly. I think there will be no expansion until they're absolutely positive what's going to happen to the Rays and what's going to happen to the A's. For the exact reason you said, Steve, something does fall apart somehow, some way, and then suddenly an expansion market gets a team very quickly and doesn't have to wait for the next expansion, then that's what needs to happen here. So we still have to wait, and it's a very tricky, tricky situation.
Half the fans here where I live are thrilled beyond words about what the Phillies have done in recent years. They're just frustrated they haven't been able to go over the top. The other half of the fans are thrilled because they got Paul Skeens. He ended up being the National League Rookie of the Year. When you look back at his season, considering that he entered the majors 10 months after being drafted, what was your thought on what you saw from him?
Well, I think he should have won the Rookie of the Year. Even though Jackson Merrill especially had a fabulous season. It's one of the greatest seasons a rookie pitcher has ever had. His 1.96 ERA was the lowest by a rookie pitcher who made at least 20 starts in the live ball era, 1920 on. That's how impressive Paul Skeens was. I think you can make a case that he was certainly the best pitcher in the National League from the minute he showed up. He's not going to win the Cy Young, nor should he, because Chris Sale is going to win the Triple Crown. But you can make a case that Paul Skeens was as good as any pitcher in the major leagues from the day he showed up until the day the season ended. And it was just overwhelming how good he was. He was so overpowering, and his combination of stuff and smarts and competitive nature, that was really impressive to watch all year.
Tim, some off seasons go through and there's some movement here or there. Then there are other seasons where the movement is all over the place and fast, furious, and occasionally dramatic. Any sense in talking to people that you talk with all the time as to what kind of off season this next month could be like?
Well, it's a pretty good free agent year when you look at what kind of free agent pitchers that we have out there. I mean, there are some difference makers in Corbin Burns and, you know, Max Fried and Snell and Sasaki. I mean, it's a pretty darn good group of starting pitchers. But I think the whole offseason is going to revolve, of course, around Juan Soto. Right. Where is he going to go? And once that domino falls, everything follows that pretty quickly. But it just seems logical that he's going to get way over $500 million. I think he's getting over $600 million. And a lot of people I talk to think he's going to get $700 million. But until he gets that from whether the Yankees or the Mets or somebody else, of course, because there are all sorts of possibilities here, I think the whole market is going to be held up a little bit until we find out what's going to happen to Juan Soto.
And that would be Scott Boras, right? That's his agent?
Right, and Scott Boras is great at what he does, and he planned on this to get Soto to free agency so the maximum number of teams could bid. And I'm sure Scott Boras is thinking we need to break the record for the largest contract ever given to a baseball player, and that's going to be part of the process.
How interested are you going to be, not just by the number, right, but by the number of years that are in there? Not just the number, but the years.
Yeah, the years are going to be really interesting because we've already heard, you know, a 14-year deal, which just sounds absurd. But when we're talking about a guy who's this good, as you know, Steve, this is a generational hitter that we're looking at here. And given his track record, he's already got over 200 home runs. Given his special plate discipline that's better than any player in the game, and he just turned 26 years old, that makes 14 years not seem as ridiculous. But I wouldn't be surprised by anything in this negotiation. And maybe Scott Boras will say, all right, we're just going to go for a 3-year deal at, you know, or a 5-year deal at $60 million and then go through free agency again when he's 31 years old. So anything is possible here because everybody recognizes what Juan Soto did for the Yankees, how he made them a significantly better offensive team the day he showed up.
You've been around Dave Dombrowski a lot during the course of your lifetime, Tim. When you look at his ability as a GM, his aggressiveness as a GM, what kind of signals can that send to Philly fans because of the kind of GM he is?
Yeah, he's one of the great GMs ever. I think he'll be a Hall of Fame executive someday. And if I were a fan of his team, I would always think Dombrowski's going to figure this out. He's going to find a way to do this because that guy never rests until he gets the team that he wants. And he's also very, very quiet about things. You know, just when the Phillies look like they're not doing anything, or the Tigers or the Marlins or the Red Sox, pow, something big happens. That's how Dave Dombrowski works. And I fully expect the Phillies to do something, maybe something big this offseason, even though they don't need to. Their team is pretty darn good, but there's no way that Dave Dombrowski is just going to sit pat when the team did not accomplish what it tried to accomplish last year.
So how do you view the state of the game right now? This is a World Series that had terrific ratings, a lot of people watching, some dramatic moments. So where do you think baseball is right now, in your opinion?
I always think it's in a good spot, Steve, because I'm hopelessly biased because I love the game so much. I like the pitch clock has changed the time of the game, made the games better, crisper. I like that attendance is going up a little bit. Ratings are going up. Again, Dodgers, Yankees had something to do with that. I love that I've never seen this kind of influx of, you know, big, strong, young, athletic players coming to the big leagues, starting with Trout and Harper, you know, 12, 13 years ago. It's amazing the talent that we see. But we still have a lot of work to do to make this a better game. We still have too many walks, too many strikeouts, too many home runs. We still don't value the hit like we should. We still don't value the starting pitcher like we should. But they're working on it. They're trying to get the game to be a better game. And I have patience enough to say, all right, these things are going to turn. But one of the first things we have to do is return the value to our starting pitchers. And instead of starting an opener or a bullpen game in the World Series, we need to find a better way to get our starting pitchers to have more of an impact on the average game.
The last part, I could agree with all of it, but the last part, I've talked about that a lot. Like you have to have a bullpen game in the postseason? Really? All right.
Yeah, the Dodgers had three of them, two in the League Championship Series and one in the World Series, and they won the World Series, which doesn't help the fact that we're trying to get more value to the starting pitcher when the Dodgers, with all their injuries, still found a way to win it by using bullpen games. I just don't think that is a healthy situation for baseball.
Tim, you can vote for as many as 10 guys in the Hall of Fame ballot, if I'm correct about that. When you look at this, when you look at this Hall of Fame ballot, what's your read on what you would like to do with it?
Well, I really haven't studied it yet, but believe me, when I sit down to do this, it is a big process for me. I think it's a pretty darn good ballot. I think Ichiro is going to go in on the first ballot, obviously as he should. I think C.C. Sabathia has a chance to go in on the first ballot. I think Billy Wagner is going to go in because it's his last year on the ballot, and he came so close last year. I think we have some other really interesting first-timers, including Felix Hernandez and Dustin Pedroia. So I find it to be a really interesting ballot, and I think they all are. But it's really hard to vote for the Hall of Fame these days. No sympathy required. It's the greatest privilege I have. But it's still a very difficult process when you have to factor in still, performance-enhancing drugs and all that stuff. It makes a very difficult assignment, but one that I love to do because of its degree of difficulty.
Yes, 75%. Extremely difficult. So when you are evaluating, you saw the players play on this ballot. What role does what you saw play into it? And do you then fall back at all on any stats along the way, either to back it up or just to make sure what you saw?
Yeah, I think it's really important to have seen the players play, from a different era. Jack Morris is now a Hall of Famer, and the numbers may not stack up as him being a Hall of Famer, but if you watched him pitch, especially on opening day 14 times, if you watched him pitch in the postseason, like Game 7 of the 91 World Series, you can believe what you saw, that guy is a Hall of Famer. So I think it really helps that I saw all of these guys play. But I also depend greatly on the statistics. And it's not my favorite, but it's one that I use often, is OPS. To me, it's the best barometer of a player. How many times you get on base? How much damage are you doing? And OPS is a very important category for me, but I factor in so many things, and I always make calls this time of year just to people who played with and against guys and said, just tell me, am I seeing this the right way? Is this guy a Hall of Famer or is he not a Hall of Famer? I still depend on that. I still think you have to do your research and do your reporting before you make your final decision.
You mentioned OPS. Is there a stat for a pitcher that you look at that to you is a swing stat?
Yeah, I mean, we have so many stats today, but I still value earned run average more than anything else. And even though I understand that wins can be a very misleading category, I'm well aware of that and have been for years and years and years. If you have a lot of wins and you have a low ERA and you have a lot of strikeouts, as Tarek Skubal and Chris Sale, both of whom won the Triple Crown of pitching this year, those are three categories that I'm always going to pay attention to. But if I have to pick one, I'm going to pick ERA because I think that is the best symbol of a pitcher's effectiveness.
I do have to ask you about Billy Wagner because he did get so close. What is influential about Billy Wagner in his career when you've really gone in depth as to what he did and did not do?
Yeah, he is basically the hardest pitcher to hit as far as hits per innings pitched. Go look at his hits per innings pitched and go look at his strikeout rate, and you put those two together and then you add in all the saves, and that's where I believe Billy Wagner is a Hall of Famer. You know, he did have some blown saves. His postseason record is not particularly good. And, you know, he didn't pitch 1,000 innings. And there are enough purists out there who feel like if you didn't pitch 1,000 innings, you can't be in the Hall of Fame. That's not true. We have guys with less than 1,000 in, but that works against Billy Wagner. But my guess is this year, last year eligible, he will get in.
When you pitch that many years, you're going to have a couple of blown saves, okay?
So, of course.
You know, that's what I always love. You know, he had a couple of blown saves. Well, no kidding. Nobody's perfect out there. My last one's going to be about Ichiro. When watching him play, what did you appreciate about him, his style of play, and how he went about his job that made him an exceptional player in your mind?
Well, he was as good at getting a hit as anyone we've seen probably since Tony Gwynn. And yeah. I still value a guy who can go up there, find an opening, and get a hit, because we don't value that anymore. His ability to hit virtually any pitch, you know, I remember his rookie year, he hit a bouncing ball, a ball that bounced before it got to home plate. And he hit it on one bounce and hit a line drive single to center field. And I called Pat Gillick, his general manager, the next day and said, "Pat, what was that all about?" And he said, "Well, he used to practice that all the time when he was in Japan. He used to practice hitting a bouncing ball just in case it came up during a game. And in that game, it did." So you take that, all the hits he got, on top of the speed, all the stolen bases, and was one of the greatest defensive right fielders with one of the greatest throwing arms I've ever seen. To me, that's the full package of Ichiro.
That I was about to bring up the last part. People don't often talk about what a great defensive player he was. He had the right angles, the arm, utilized his speed the right way. I loved how he played defense.
Yeah, and Bobby Valentine once told me that Ichiro is a mathematical genius. And he said the reason he was such a great outfielder beyond his athleticism is he could see the angles of the ball and the field better than others could. So when he sees a ball go up in the air, he could tell from his mathematical background where to run to intercept that ball and catch it. But that's what Bobby Valentine told me. I never forgot that. That was very interesting to me. But Ichiro is a great defensive player. And when you're that good on both sides of the ball, you're a first ballot Hall of Famer, obviously.
Well, you're a Hall of Famer, and I appreciate the time you gave us today, Tim. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
Tim Kirchen. And yes, he is a Hall of Famer. Right? I love the story he told when he was making the ride over on the bus to Cooperstown. And I love this story. He's sitting next to Sandy Koufax. Sandy Koufax. Now, everybody, of course, Sandy Koufax, fastball, curveball, no hitters, perfect game, World Series. And Tim sits next to him. And he talks to him about Sandy Koufax when he played for the University of Cincinnati basketball team. Because he knew his background. Right? Playing for the University of Cincinnati basketball team. And that was the conversation on the way over. Right? And Sandy Koufax, you could, based on how Tim tells the story, you could tell appreciated so much that like Tim knew so much more about him than just being a pitcher. It's great. Great, great story. Loved it. This half hour being brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, and online at sunburymotors.com. Ford Kia Hyundai, best in new inventory, great pre-owned inventory with the Sunbury Motors Guarantee, great service department, quick lane, inspections, routine, difficult. They handle it all at Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.